I want to welcome another group of Warsaw East High School students. Would they all stand, please? Thank you. You may be seated. We welcome you all here with the State Bar and the Wisconsin Supreme Court Court for the Class program, which has won two national awards. You have received a summary of the case that we are about to hear. And for those in the room who wish a copy of that summary, they're available outside on one of the desks. Now that you all have been introduced to us, I'd like to introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babich, and to his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley from Warsaw. And to her immediate left is Justice David Prosser. This group will join the colleagues from Warsaw East High School that were here just before you at noon, and Justice Patrick Crooks will speak with you. With those matters taken care of, I call the second case for today, 97-3191, State v. Is it Smith or Smythe?
Smythe.
And, counsel, you have 25 minutes representing Mr. Smythe.
Thank you. I am Ralph Kalol. I represent Ralph Smythe. That's not just the introduction, that's a statement of the case and a statement of the issue. I represent Mr. Smythe. I am not Mr. Smythe, and he is not me. In The Godfather, from time to time, Don Corleone finds it necessary to eliminate a subordinate with whom he has found grounds for disfavor. He always, in the course of executing that order, and I mean the execute in a little bit more literal sense than the legal term of art, explains that this is not personal, it's business. But even Don Corleone, he has an intuitive understanding of due process, because he executes the person that he is mad at. He doesn't execute the person standing next to that man. In this case, Judge Dykeman executed Mr. Smythe because he was mad at me. And it is our position that the Court of Appeals cannot do that. It cannot do that because it violates the most elementary concept of due process. He cannot do that because it is not the purpose of the rule upon which the court relied, 809-83-2.
What if, in his order, either, I think it was the January 9th order or the January 2nd order, instead of making mention of your problem or the extensive history that you have had, that they perceived anyway, their record, let's say they made no mention of it whatsoever, but simply said, we deny the motion due to the inadequate showing made of good cause in this particular matter.
That, in my opinion, would be an abuse of discretion, but it would not be a constitutional issue of the variety that we have here. However, you certainly do not, in the present case, have two independent grounds for taking an action. You have accumulations. Because of all of these...
Why would it be an abuse of discretion? 809.83 subsection 2, entitled Noncompliance with Rules, gives the court the authority to do that.
Gives the court the authority to do that by saying it is grounds. It does not say, however, that it is an appropriate exercise. The rule confers upon the court the authority to fashion a remedy that is remedial and consistent with the nature of the conduct in need of being remedied. Any rule that confers on a court the authority to do things for purposes of expediting the litigation, for purposes of keeping the litigants on track, whatever discretionary determination is ever given the authority to make, it is always subject to the understanding that is implicit in the doctrine, even if we're talking an inherent exercise of inherent authority, that the measure of what is done must have some proportion to the situation that needs to be remedied. And that is clear from all of the various decisions cited in our brief that address other situations where the courts have the authority to impose sanctions on counsel as a consequence of some act or action done in the course of the case. The ultimate core...
Counsel, we allow courts to dismiss actions all the time for failure to comply with time deadlines.
That is true, but it is not the first course of action that the court can take. And this court's past decisions have shown that where there is to be a dismissal as a result of failure to comply with a non-jurisdictional time deadline, and even this rule makes it clear that a failure to comply with some order does not affect jurisdiction.
Well, isn't this akin, I get the point that I make, isn't this akin to a statute of limitations or a time deadline set for filing an answer, which if you don't meet it, default judgment can be entered? Why isn't this akin to that?
Certainly not the former, because the former would be, in the functional sense at any rate, jurisdictional. The cause of action dies, and this rule clearly says that doesn't happen. If what you are talking about is the failure to file an answer, the failure to file an answer can, in certain circumstances, lead to the imposition of a default judgment. However, the cases in which this court and the Court of Appeals have evaluated whether it is appropriate to impose such a drastic sanction have recognized that that is not a remedy that should be applied lightly, and that it is not something that should be, it essentially shouldn't be used if the type of omission is not one of the most egregious nature. The focus, even in the context of default judgments, has not been on whether the answer is a day late. The focus has been primarily on the extent to which it disrupted, in that case, the process.
Mr. Kahlo, what do you think would have been an appropriate sanction in this particular situation?
I don't think there is an appropriate sanction in this particular situation because I don't think I did anything wrong. There is in Robert's
Rules of Order. Well, the fact is you didn't get your briefing on time. Isn't that correct?
That's true. But I don't regard that as something for which there is any appropriate sanction because I think it was explained and understandable. In Robert's Rules of Order, there is a thing known as a point of personal privilege, and I would love if there were such an opportunity available to me to express my opinion about some of the substance of what's been said about me and my firm. But I don't think that's why I'm here today, and I don't think that that's what the court is interested in hearing me talk about. You ask the question, my answer is none. I don't think I did anything wrong.
How do you think the Court of Appeals is to enforce in a meaningful fashion its deadlines if it's not able to sanction people who do not follow those deadlines?
Well, it clearly has the ability. You asked me if I thought it should in this case.
And you said no.
I said no. It's clear that the Court of Appeals has a panoply of legal abilities, even under this rule, to impose sanctions on me directly.
So what do you think they should have done? Now, you did not file your brief on time, and I can just tell you that I have to schedule cases here on behalf of the court. Uh-huh. I've got to make up a calendar for the court and advise all the lawyers and get the cases set up so that we can hear them in a timely fashion and be prompt. And if people do not file those briefs on time, I cannot do that on behalf of the court. And frankly, when we set up the schedule, and then lawyers don't come through with briefs as promised, it's very inconvenient, not only for the court, but for other lawyers and other litigants. And although there are exceptions, most clients want their cases done promptly. So, what are we going to do if you don't bring in your brief promptly?
I don't think that I can answer that question in a generic sense. if you are saying what should the court have done in this case, since my position is that I have not done anything improper, that my request was reasonable and justified, and that the court should have granted it, I'm pretty well constrained on part of my own personal opinion to answer nothing.
Well, why do you think you were your request, and you're right, you were supposed to file a brief timely, but you have an opportunity to file a motion to file it late. Okay, so you filed that motion. Did you give reasonable grounds in the motion?
I believe we did.
What did you say in the motion?
I explained that the attorney to him who was assigned had taken a Christmas vacation, and as a consequence of that, we were asking for a 5-day extension over to Christmas holiday.
When did you file the brief, Mr. Cagle? When did you ultimately file the brief in this case?
We filed that brief the day, that fifth day.
Filed it fifth day?
Before the court had acted on the request for extension and denied it, we filed the brief with the clerk of courts, and indeed the Court of Appeals never returned it. They still have it.
And so you were sanctioned by this case dismissed after your brief was in. Is that your position?
That's correct. The court denied the motion for extension, then dismissed the action because no brief had been filed.
But you say the brief was there.
They have it. They've had it all along.
Was it there when Judge Dykeman dismissed the action?
Yes.
The brief was there.
The brief was there on the day that we had promised it to be there. Had the motion been granted, that brief would have been there on the exact date due.
Your position in your brief is that although you have requested extensions of time for filing brief, that those requests have decreased, if I read your brief properly.
Well, that's correct, and it's also our position that we have asked for far fewer requests proportionally than any of our opponents.
And are these counts, body counts, a matter of record?
They are in the affidavit that was submitted in support of our second motion, so yes. And I'd like to go back to one other point that is suggested by your inquiry, which is that all of those, of course, were granted, which suggests that they must have been properly grounded. When we talk, as I believe we ought to be in this case, about sanctions, it seems to me that the question is not what sanction should have been imposed. This court has empowered the Court of Appeals to impose sanctions on counsel directly. The question that I believe brings this case to this court is whether or not the client can be shot because the judge is mad at the lawyer.
Let me make sure that I have the focus right. I see you transitioning, and that helps me. Thus far, the discussion has been in large part on whether or not the motion should be granted, the motion for an extension of time, whether or not there was good cause. But as I see your argument, it's not so much whether or not the motion should be granted, although that's there, but really the focus is on whether or not there was a reasonable exercise of discretion in imposing this sanction. Now, tell me if I'm wrong on that focus, that the focus is more on the exercise of discretion. You know, you look at the Ellis Chalmers case and the things you're supposed to consider.
And it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that because, first of all, I think it's an abuse of discretion to dismiss somebody's case because they're 5 days late with a brief, especially when they filed a timely motion requesting an extension of 5 days, and you just say, no. That is a disproportionate thing to do to the litigant.
When you say disproportionate, give me the elements that a court is to consider based on case law in exercising its discretion as to what is an appropriate sanction.
Well, the tenor that I get out of the cases that deal with circuit courts that grant default judgments because of failure to timely answer and things of that sort includes the nature of the delay, the extent of the delay, the reasons for the delay, and ultimately the extent to which the delay has constituted at some level a prejudice to the opposing side or a major problem with the administration of justice.
Yep.
But it goes beyond just the issue of discretion, because the core point that we filed our petition on, and the core point that I think is critical in this case, is where you aim. I don't particularly, for purposes of this case, care what sanction the Court of Appeals imposes on me. I'm a big boy. You give me a venue in which to argue that one, and I will be happy to do so. As a practical matter, there's an extraordinarily disproportionate level of power between judges and the lawyers that appear in front of them. And most lawyers, frankly, if the judge is going to say, I'm going to do something to you, are going to say, sorry, sir, and take the hit. But what happened here is no scars, no marks, nothing. I haven't been touched, but Ralph Smythe's case is dead, which does nothing to me.
Well, you might be touched later.
Hey, fine. That's where it ought to go, if that's what's going to happen. This court has rules. This court has the Board of Attorneys' professional responsibility. The rule that the Court of Appeals relied on, I'm a person. They can impose a sanction on me directly. They can say, it's going to cost you $1,000, Kalo. Do it again, it's going to be two. That isn't something that I would be here saying they can't constitutionally do. What I'm saying is they cannot constitutionally say, Kalo, we have had it with you. You've been doing this for months, and this is the straw that breaks Mr. Smythe's back. Because Mr. Smythe, you guys and ladies have put me out there with a license to do what I do, which at least at some level constitutes, if not an endorsement. You said I have minimal levels of competence. Mr. Smythe is the consumer. He may have steered clear of buying a Bronco, but he went out and he hired himself a licensed professional to defend his drunk driving case. He went into court. He went and appealed. He told his lawyer to fight it. He did everything that he personally could do to defend his case. And he didn't in any way, shape, fashion, or form have the slightest complicity in whatever I did to screw it up. I have a question over here that I owe somebody an answer to, and I didn't catch where it came from.
You've answered it when you were addressing Justice Bradner's question.
I have a question, however. During the 2 years preceding the action that was taken in the Smythe case, had either you or your firm in any way been sanctioned by the Court of Appeals, by district court, for the filing of briefs on a rather regular, late basis?
No. There was one case, and I believe it is referred to in Judge Dykeman's second order, in which they declined to allow us to file a reply brief and decided the case without the benefit of that brief.
Is that the 1996 case?
Moselle?
Pardon me?
That...
There's a reference here, Moselle.
Yes.
The letter dated 18 September.
Correct.
Was there some warning given when that action was taken?
No.
Well, Mr., just to follow that up, if I may, Justice, on page, appendix 6, in Judge Dykeman's first order, he states, quote, we have advised counsel, which I presume is you, that extension motions based on counsel's heavy workload fail to make the showing of good cause when they become routine. And then on page 19 of this, which is Judge Dykeman's second order, he states, we have made it clear that we have concluded our normal procedures are inadequate to address appellant counsel's, which I presume is you, excessive extension motions. I was led to believe by those that somehow they have gotten the word to you or your firm that, hey, you've pushed the envelope too far.
I think that it would be fair to say that in a couple of their orders, they have indicated that good cause is shown, but have indicated essentially that they were reluctant because they viewed that there had been more requests than they would like. I will not dispute that. I would not say that they have, with the clarity that is suggested by Judge Dykeman's order, said, you do this again, you're gonna be wasted.
But they found good cause.
They found good cause.
Was it?
And Anyway, I don't think it matters for purposes of what we're talking about today, because the question isn't whether they were entitled to get mad. The question is whether they were entitled to take it out on Mr. Smythe instead of his lawyer. And I think that's just a crucial distinction, because what we are dealing with here is, you all kind of smiled when I said, do you hold me out at a certain level of competence because I'm one of those licensed professionals against whom grievances can be filed and things of that sort. But there is a concept. We talk about professional football players, and I always cringe when I hear that term, because professional, in the common understood traditional sense of the term, implies a person with unique educational capabilities and a specialized standard of conduct, doctors, lawyers, and clergy traditionally, that people can rely upon to provide very personal and important services. It is because of the need for a certain level of protection of the public from people who aren't qualified that we have an obligation to be admitted to a regulated bar, ultimately subject to the control of this court. So this isn't like Mr. Smythe goes out and gets himself a plumber or a mechanic for his car and doesn't like the result, and hey, you picked it tough. This is a situation in which, as a practical matter, the person does everything that can be reasonably expected of him, and through no fault of his own, he ends up getting the most hideous sanction possible imposed upon him by the court for what occurred not just in his case, but because the court has decided to make an example of his counsel for what has occurred in other cases over time preceding his case.
Does this mean that the court can never call into account any past actions of counsel as being repetitive, or are you saying that it only can be based on what I did in the Smythe case? Nothing else counts.
No, I'm not saying either of those things. What I'm saying is you can do anything you want to me for whatever I've done,
I understand.
Whatever I've done. But if you're going to, under 80983-2, do something to Mr. Smythe, the maximum you can do is do it to him for what I've done in that case.
Well, let me just look at your filing. And you say that you were, you filed, what is it, 53 opening briefs or petitions for review and 27 reply briefs for a total of 80 filings. You requested 15 extensions. Judge Dykeman says, this analysis is unconvincing for several reasons. I'm reading from A-17. First, it includes filings in the Supreme Court, and that they don't care what you do in other courts. They only care what you do in their court.
They ought to, because whether it's reasonable or not does, in my opinion, depend on what happens in the appeals courts.
Do you know how many of those were in our courts and how many were petitions for review and how many were not?
I didn't break it out at the time. My hunch would be that there's probably somewhere between 10 and 15 petitions for review in that total.
Okay. He then goes on to say that the information is irrelevant because the time to file a petition is jurisdictional. So he eliminates that and he says you have to be good because otherwise you're out of court. Okay. Third, our concern about counsel extension record would be unchanged even if it is true that the number requested by his firm in this court is no greater than that requested by his opponents. That is because his opponents are usually municipal or state agencies which have virtually no control over their caseloads or budgets. Counsel, on the other hand, has complete control of both of those elements in his practice. Therefore, it's reasonable to expect that counsel's firm should be better able to conduct its business in a timely fashion which doesn't burden this court with routine motions and unnecessarily prolonged litigation.
That merely suggests the judge likes prosecutors and much better than he likes defense
lawyers. Well,
because
I think
the reality is that
suggests that he thinks that that he should treat state and city officers different than he treats private practice.
Yes, and there's no reason for that because, first, if you look at this, since we are almost always the appellant, we're filing twice as many briefs. So functionally, we've asked for a rate of extensions that's half what our opponents have asked. Second, we would look at it as a situation in which we represent the little guy. We're the ones that are dealing with relatively small resources as opposed to those state and municipal agencies that have large budgets and, as a practical proposition, appear on the face of it to be able to get quite frequent extensions without too much effort, because the statistics that you're looking at in this case say they get extensions at a rate that's twice what we do. If we file 80 briefs, opening and reply, they file 40. And if you add petitions to review into that, it becomes even more, because there aren't necessarily responses in those, and frequently are none filed where the Attorney General's office is not involved in the case because the state's a plaintiff. I think that is a disingenuous explanation for a discrimination between the litigant represented by private counsel and the government agency that's represented by House counsel. As a practical proposition, when you look at the disparity between the resources available to the state of Wisconsin and the resources available to Ralph Smythe, there is no comparison.
Mr. Kalo, right?
Yes.
One last question from me, anyway. When Judge Dykeman exercised his authority here, he did it as the presiding judge, is that correct? He did not refer this to a panel?
I assume so. I do not know. My understanding, and it is merely an understanding, I candidly suspect this court would be in a better position to know than I, is that there is a judge of the Court of Appeals that is assigned on a weekly basis to deal with requests of this sort, but I really don't know. They have an internal operating procedure, and that one I didn't look up. I didn't actually anticipate that question. Okay. My assumption has always been that it was Judge Dykeman sitting alone.
Counsel, would a single judge have sat on the ultimate merits of this case?
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm James McDermott, and I'm appearing here this morning for the state of Wisconsin. I think and I submit that there is one principal issue that's involved in this court, on this case, and that issue was the dismissal sanction imposed on Smythe, and it was imposed on Mr. Smythe, for reasons distinct from and unrelated to the increase in extension requests, which was one of the reasons why the Court of Appeals denied Smythe's extension request. Now, fortunately, the record here shows that, and it undoubtedly shows, that Judge Dykeman, in imposing this particular sanction, this appeal dismissal, did so with no consideration given to the extension requests whatsoever. That is not a factor and was not a factor in the court imposing the sanction which it did impose. When it denied the extension request, it made it very clear that its first reason for the denial was its observation of a recent increase in extension requests coming from my opponent's firm. And it gave as the second reason what it described as, and I'll quote, a complete absence of any showing of why the brief could not be completed during the 5 weeks before counsel's vacation.
Counsel,
let me say here that, as I recall, it wasn't Mr. Kalal who filed a motion for the time enlargement. I believe it was a lawyer in his employ who did so. And she said that she had had a plan for a Christmas vacation, and she wanted to go on the vacation, and so she needed this extension of time. And I think under those circumstances, the Court of Appeals was completely justified in taking the attitude that it did take and in denying the extension request. But it did take into consideration the previous extension requests that had been made by Mr. Kalal's firm. Now, let me point out something at this juncture, that in his reply brief, Mr. Kalal had an opportunity which he simply did not exercise to make an argument, and I'm going to slip back here to...
Can I just interrupt you?
Pardon?
I'm going to interrupt you for a moment.
Yes.
In the first order on January 2, 1998...
Yes.
As I read it, and I'm on A5 of the blue brief.
Okay. All right.
The judge just states here that the motion says that the vacation is the problem. Okay?
That's what it says. That's part of the problem.
And then he notes that the affidavit and all previous papers were filed by Attorney Kalal, right?
Yes.
That's what it says. Okay.
The motion was filed by... I'm not debating that.
All right. I don't find that relevant. Others here might. Then the second paragraph of that says, repeats that the council has had a long history, okay, of extension motions.
Yes.
And then it winds up, that increase in the extension motions, combined with the motion's complete absence of showing why it couldn't be completed, so the two are combined, with the first one given as the background, that is the practice here.
Yes.
Leads us to conclude that good cause has not been shown, therefore we deny the motion.
For the extension request.
Yes. And then it goes on to say, then it refers to a 1996 case of this attorney.
Yes.
And then it goes on to say that our usual sanction for failure to file an appellant's brief is dismissal. Now, I've been on this court 22 years. Many attorneys have asked for extensions. For short times, they're ordinarily granted. In fact, they're granted by one of these staff attorneys of the court, one of the court commissioners. If it goes on too long and it's repeated, it then comes to my office and it's discussed. And then an order is given saying either come in or if there's deep trouble.
Yes.
You're familiar with that practice.
Yes.
Of this court. So the attorney is given an extension if there's good cause, then given warning, given a final date, and fortunately, when this has happened, the law firm or the state office that has been concerned assigns another lawyer, and that brief is in timely.
Yes.
If people don't show up here, our court has two, as I understand it, two possible courses of action. One, we proceed without counsel's brief, because the matter is here.
Mm-hmm.
Or two, we will dismiss the case for failing to prosecute.
Yes.
Right. Now, here, after a request on December 29th, is a dismissal, 30, 31, 1, holiday, 2, 4 days later. Do you view that as a reasonable position of the court in light of what the general practice is, at least on this appellate court?
Do I think this is reasonable? In other words, do I believe this was not an erroneous exercise of discretion?
No, I'm going to do first reasonable.
Pardon?
Just first reasonable, because the rule on erroneous exercise of discretion is if there are two reasonable alternatives and the judge picks one, it's okay. I'm just asking if it's reasonable.
I don't think this is unreasonable at all, not under the circumstances.
What are the circumstances?
What are the circumstances? Well, again, you've got the circumstances where, and this didn't go to the appeal dismissal.
I'll give you one circumstance, okay?
Yes.
And this is the one you really want to rely on, I think. The one circumstance is that the brief is due December 29. Lawyer comes in December 29 and asks for an extension until January 6 because the lawyer is going to be on vacation.
That's right.
Right. Is it reasonable to deny that request and dismiss?
It is. I think that the lawyer, under those circumstances, what? Asking for that extension is demonstrating nothing but pure, rank chutzpah, and that it is not a good reason to grant the extension, and were I the judge, I would have denied it. That's the way I feel about it, Your Honor.
Okay, so your position then is any time a lawyer asks for an extension at the last minute because somebody's going on vacation is grounds for dismissing that client's case. That's your position.
That isn't the only reason they gave them.
Okay, but just take that position. Is that your position just with that reason?
Just standing alone.
Standing alone.
Standing alone? Yes, that would be my position.
Your position, okay.
I think. But this doesn't stand alone. This doesn't stand alone. There's another reason, and it's a very substantial reason. And let me say, to return to an argument that I was about to make, that Mr. Kalal, in his reply brief, doesn't try to cope at all with our argument that the court, in denying the extension request, properly and rightly and appropriately considered the numerous extension requests made previously by his firm. He never tries to touch that argument. He does not rebut it, and the reason he doesn't is because he can't. Because the consideration by the court of those numerous extension requests.
Just a second, Mr. McDonough. Maybe I'm listening to a different case here, but it seems to me his entire brief, in fairness to Mr. Kalal, talks about you can't visit the sins of the father upon the sons. I mean, seems to me that his entire argument is responsive to what you're saying.
Well, his entire argument is based on the idea that the court, in imposing the sanction of appeal dismissal, did so, that one of the bases for doing so was these extensive requests. And it is not, as the court itself in its order, and I love the language that Judge Dykeman employed, the court made it perfectly clear that it was dismissing the appeal for, of course, failure to file the appellant's brief.
Which date are you looking at? January 2 or January 9?
I'm looking
9?
At January 2 now, Your Honor. And in doing so, it explained, it gave an explication of why it was taking that step. And it said, it pointed out to a previous case where they denied a similar extension motion by Mr. Kalal's firm. They allowed the respondent to decide whether it wished to file a brief on the merits. They didn't get any briefs at all. They reviewed the decision appealed from on the merits without briefs, and then they explained why they declined to do so in this case, and they gave a very logical and sound explanation saying, and I'm going to quote and read rapidly, that procedure essentially gives the appellant the benefit of an appeal without the effort of writing briefs. This court, in effect, acts as appellant's counsel. Furthermore, review of the merits is a more difficult and time-consuming process when the court is not assisted by briefing. Now, if I may go further.
Counsel, let me, if I may, interrupt.
Yeah.
The Johnson Alice Chalmers case indicates that when a court is dealing with the question of whether or not to impose sanctions, that the court has to consider the egregious conduct in the case. What is the egregious conduct in this case?
Well, let me first of all say, Your Honor, that I don't really think that we have a case or case law, well, Mr. Kalal thinks otherwise, that says that you can, acting under 809-83, paren 2, only impose the sanction of appeal dismissal where you have egregious conduct that would justify that. But I think here, certainly if that law could be said to apply, that you can make out a case for egregious misconduct here.
Yeah, my understanding of the Alice Chalmers case is that it's an element for consideration.
And that it applies in any situation, including, Your Honor, a court's action by this court or by the Court of Appeals under 80983.
So I return to the question then, what is the egregious conduct in this case?
Well, I think the egregious conduct is, and I think it is egregious, this last moment resort to a time enlargement request with the feeble and insubstantial excuse that, well, I've planned a Christmas vacation. There's incidentally, may I point out, that in that motion for that time enlargement, there's no indication by the lawyer making it as to how long she had planned the Christmas vacation. She might have planned it on Christmas Eve for all the motion shows.
Then it's your position that any request for a five-day extension, any first-time request for a five-day extension for purposes of a vacation constitutes egregious conduct? Is that your position?
No, not any first-time. Any last minute.
Okay.
On the eve of the time when the brief is due request.
Okay, and that's what makes it egregious in your mind.
That's sufficiently egregious as far as I'm concerned.
That it was, the request came on the date that the brief was due. That's what makes it egregious in this case?
Yes, it certainly does, I think. But let me get to what is perhaps the heart of the matter here. I thought that Mr. Kalal had gone pretty far in his initial brief when, as I recall, he said that the Court of Appeals really in imposing this sanction was seeking to, and I quote his exact language, wreak vengeance upon him. He's gone a little further. I noticed in his opening argument he is now comparing the Court of Appeals to a fictional mafia don who executed people who incurred his displeasure. There is absolutely, I submit, Your Honors, nothing in the record here to justify Mr. Kalal's view that the Court of Appeals, in imposing the dismissal sanction, was acting in a spirit of vengeance, of reprisal against him for the numerous extension requests. It simply is not borne out by the record. And for one thing, the record shows clearly and unequivocally, as I've said before, and I'll say it just this once more, that the frequency of motions for time enlargements, briefing time enlargements, was not a factor at all in producing the appeal dismissal. Now, was that appeal dismissal? He hasn't made much of it in his opening argument, in fact, virtually none. Question, was there any violation of procedural or substantive due process in the imposition of this particular sanction? As a matter of fact, certainly none on procedural due process. Whether you consider...
Can I take you back to your last conclusion?
Pardon?
Can I take you back to your...
Yes, yes.
You said that it was not that Mr. Kalal's tardiness in the past was not a factor at all in dismissing.
That's right.
Well, technically, that's correct. I'm sure, because they didn't mention that. They simply said, this is our sanction for... But they were the ones that caused it. I mean, isn't that somewhat tantamount to the person who kills his parents and then begs for the mercy of the court on the grounds that he's an orphan?
Yeah.
I mean, they're the ones that caused the brief not to be filed by denying the motion.
Well, of course, Mr. Kalal says he filed the brief. He filed it improperly and unlawfully, and is filing as a meaningless thing. It's a nullity. But I think my answer to your question, Your Honor, or your statement that they caused the failure to file the brief. I don't think that's correct.
Well, the two seem so connected to me, counsel.
Pardon?
The two seem so very connected. The Court of Appeals saying, well, we're going to dismiss this because it's because there's no brief here, but ignoring the fact that there's no brief there because they denied the extension.
Yes, but why? The reason that he brought about the situation, the misfortune that we're talking about that befell Mr. Smythe, if you want to put it that way, all that can be laid at the doorstep of the failure to timely file the brief, and then this last-minute request for a time enlargement. I don't see where any blame at all, where there's any culpability involved whatsoever for the Court of Appeals. And to say that there's a connection between the numerous extension requests and the appeal sanction will require this court, if I may say so, to in effect point at the Court of Appeals and say that that court was dissembling, that it was actually withholding the real reason, or one of the real reasons, for which it imposed the dismissal sanction. And I can't believe, I know the Court of Appeals, I've appeared frequently before it, and I think quite a bit about the judiciary of this state, and I simply do not believe that Judge Dykeman's opinion here was an exercise in some kind of deceit, seeking to mislead as to the genuine reasons for the appeal dismissal. He spelled out why they resorted to appeal dismissal. He did it very well, and in that spelling out, there is not an iota of mention of the numerous extension requests.
Counsel, I want to talk about what he did spell out. In response to my question about what is the egregious conduct in this case, because that's what the court is supposed to consider in imposing sanctions, the egregiousness of the conduct, your response was that the request was last minute. The request came on the date that the brief was due. Since you made that response, I took the opportunity of going through the two orders of the court, and they don't make any mention of that being a reason. Let me ask the question in a little different way. What was the egregious conduct that the record reflects the Court of Appeals relied on in imposing a sanction in this case? What was the egregious conduct in this case that the Court of Appeals relied on in imposing its sanction?
Well, I would say that you might put it this way, that particular egregious conduct was the conduct which produced a situation where the court had no brief from the appellant and might conceivably then have had no brief from the respondent. There's no question about it that it was the conduct of the appellant which led to the fact that the appellant did not timely file his brief. That was his conduct. It wasn't the fault of the court. Now, granted, the court did issue an order denying the extension, but that in itself was also the product of the conduct of the Kalal law firm. And then again, on the question of the egregiousness of conduct that's involved here, I think, and I neglected to say so in my initial response to you, Your Honor, I think you have to take into consideration that the court felt that there was, and I quote Judge Dykeman's exact language, he referred to this motion's complete absence of any showing of why the brief could not be completed during the 5 weeks before counsel's vacation. There was ample time to do that. I prepared hundreds of briefs under time deadlines, and my experience, speaking from personal experience, and Mr. Kalal has done a little of this, But my experience is that the briefing time periods that are established by statute or by court rule or sometimes by court order are ordinarily amply generous, and you don't need time enlargements. Now, I don't stand here before the court and represent that I've never asked for a time enlargement, but rarely, and I think the court was perfectly justified in looking at the situation. There were 5 weeks for this particular lawyer to have done the job, and it wasn't done when it could have been and should have been. Does the court wish to hear me at all on this question of whether or not there was a violation of due process?
Sure.
Perhaps not. I don't know. I submit.
You still have the green light.
I've got some time. Certainly procedural due process, that was granted to Mr. Kalal, and the mechanics of it was simply this. When the appeal dismissal came down and the denial for the extension request or of it, he filed a renewal of his motion for an extension. And he did a thorough job presenting the reasons for that renewal. That was filed with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals not just didn't take notice of it and then brush it aside with a cursory light brush treatment, but instead issued its order of January 9, 1998, and dealt very thoroughly and very conscientiously with the issues and the arguments raised by Mr. Kalal. He had procedural due process to the hilt. Now, was there a violation of substantive due process? There very likely would have been had the Court of Appeals, in considering whether or not it would, what sanction it was going to employ, had the Court of Appeals then considered the extension requests as a reason for imposing the appeal dismissal sanction, I think you could fairly say that there would very likely be a violation of substantive due process, an essential and basic unfairness, because you'd be considering matters outside the scope of Mr. Smyth's particular case. That did not take place, Your Honors, and so there was no violation whatsoever of due process, substantive or procedural. I'll close on that.
I got a question, Mr. McDermott.
Oh, yes.
A question, sir. I want to give you a hypothetical.
Just a hypothetical.
Yes.
What if the only ground relied upon by the court in dismissing Smythe's appeal was the Kalal's firm's past indiscretions with respect to, not indiscretions, their past failures to timely file? What if they made no reference to anything else? They said, we can't tolerate this anymore, and therefore we dismiss Smythe's appeal because of their failure. Would there be anything wrong with that?
Yeah, I think there would be. In all candor, I think under those circumstances, there would be a consideration by the court of things, the record in Mr. Smyth's case, outside of the scope of that case, and they're probably, I'm not a judge, but in my own personal opinion would be, in all probability, there'd be at least an excellent argument to be made that there was a violation of substantive due process under those circumstances.
Counsel, I want to extend Justice Babbage's hypothetical. He said if that was the only reason that the court used. In my extension, let's say it's one of two reasons that the court used. Would that still constitute a denial of substantive due process if it was a consideration by the court?
If I were the lawyer representing the person who'd been on the receiving end of the appeal dismissal under those circumstances, I would make the poison well argument. I would argue that although there were two reasons given, one of them was invalid from a constitutional viewpoint, and that therefore that particular appeal dismissal was invalid.
In fact, I heard you to say there would have been a substantive due process, likely would have been, had the Court of Appeals considered the past requests. But your argument is they didn't consider
the past
request.
They did not. I say that the record establishes beyond any doubt whatsoever that they did not. I'll close on that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Oh,
thank you.
All right.
Well, you can't sum it up neater than that, because that's where it is, and I don't think you can read the Court of Appeals orders without saying that that was what they were talking about. History. They spent a lot of words on it if it wasn't a central factor in what they did. I have only one other remark.
Let me ask you, counsel, so that means that if we have a case like this, court cannot talk about history because that poisons the will, so it has to be simply on this particular case. Just
in this business, Judge, words have meaning. And when the words "due to appellant's counsel's long history of extension motions" are used, I don't think there's any alternative.
Sure. I understand that, counsel. I'm just asking you that, as we all, as you do, as everyone talks about, well, this happened and that, but if there is a primary reason, and that is the judge said here, look, it's a day, you should have had it in before, whatever. But when he does this, he or she does this, do you think that would poison the will, so to speak, and not allow a sanction which would involve your client?
Why would the court be talking about it if it wasn't a factor in its consideration? I guess the answer is, if I'm to assume that the court addresses its remarks to topics it believes to be germane and doesn't simply speak idly, then I guess the answer is that that probably isn't something the court would want to be talking about if it wasn't thinking about it. I don't want to leave the impression that I'm comparing the Court of Appeals to mythical figures of organized crime, not even Judge Dyckman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Now, before adjourning, I just remind the students from Wauwatosa East High School that they will, in about 5 minutes or so, receive a presentation by Justice Crooks as to the total operation of the courts in Wisconsin. So if you'll...